I saw your tweet about, was it National Book Lovers Day? Is that what it was?
Yep.
And I totally missed it. I was like, I felt like a complete failure, Mike.
It's cool. It's cool. Especially after reading this book about social media.
I know.
You're forgiven.
I try to keep up with some of those National Puppy Day, like some of those types of things, but I notice them like 2 days late.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrible. And I've been that way for a long time. Even like some bloggers are really good about, they'll write an article for Father's Day or Christmas is coming up, and they'll write an article that somehow correlates to whatever's going on the calendar. I've never been able to do that. I never get it right. And I don't know why. I just don't.
I only saw it because it was trending.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what's trending on Instagram or Twitter. Those are lifesavers sometimes. Like what was it? Twitter Moments, when that came out, there was a lot of people upset about it because they're like, this doesn't make sense. It won't work out. I'm like, that is one of the best sources of news I get for some reason. It's like the one place
exactly.
I go. It's like, okay, even myself, I'm like, I don't think this is such a great idea. And here I am checking it at least twice a day. Don't tell Cal Newport, but that's just, it's a place I go.
Twitter is a great source for news, in my opinion, because no matter which way you lean, if you were to go to an actual news site, you're going to get very, very biased coverage.
Right.
And there's a really good, maybe we can put this on a list at some point, but Simon Sinek has a book called Leaders Eat Last, where he talks a little bit about that, about the shift of when news sites stopped being truly news sites, and it was really more of like the spin that was put on the news to get more readers. And it's really interesting, but after you read it, you're like, yeah, I can't trust anybody anymore. But Twitter gives you at least a snapshot of what the world is thinking about current events, in my opinion.
Yeah, I know that working for a corporation and doing a lot of data analysis and then paying attention to what some of the scientists within our company were working on and seeing how they went about publishing articles about the stuff that they were researching, it's crazy how the more you know about something, the less you trust it. So
it's true.
I totally get it. So here's a real question. So talking about cutting back on things, that's my awesome segue there. How's the minimizing process going after reading The More of Less?
It's going to be a long process, I believe, but I have embarked on the journey, and a few things that have been close to my heart for a long time, I am actually in the process of giving some things away. So I mentioned before, actually during the episode, that I kind of started this process before I even read the book with guitars. And then it's gone into technology devices, although I do have a little bit of a confession to make there a little bit later. And then the other big thing is bags. I have been a collector of bags for a long time. I don't even know why, but
like, you're not talking like grocery bags, but
no, I'm talking about like backpacks, messenger bags. Like, I don't know why, but I have, I think 5 or 6 Timbuktu bags.
What?
And as I'm going through my stuff, I'm like, I don't need that one. I don't need that one. And I'm already have targets in mind of people to give those to, but I have not actually given them away yet. I did give the computer away that I was telling you about last time. And that was an incredibly rewarding experience. I should have seen the look on this guy's face. And as I gave it to him at church where I saw him, and then I was actually on worship team. So we were practicing before service, and I see him in the hallway, and he's just like dancing in the hallway because he's got this old MacBook Air that I couldn't use anymore. So that was really cool. And it really created momentum and makes me want to give more stuff away. So it's
nice.
Happening.
Nice. Wow, you are way on this one. This is, okay, so I have attempted to go down this path, but for me, it's a lot simpler, I guess, because I didn't really have a ton of things to begin with. So for me, it's mostly I've kept some of my old notebooks around that I've taken notes in. I don't know why I kept these things, but I did get rid of some of those. I didn't even feel the need to scan them in. Some people feel like they need to scan that stuff in. I just don't. I don't see it. I don't see the point. So I threw them away. Obviously, you can't use them. All the pages are written on them. So I haven't gone through a lot of things to try to donate, like what you're saying. But in my case, it's a lot of find the things I don't need and throw it away and, you know, let my girls play with it. That's pretty much the extent of what it's been for me. So nothing near as fun. But, okay, are you going to get to this whole computer thing later? It sounds like you bought something. Like, you can't talk about getting rid of things.
I did not buy anything. This is not my fault.
It's not your fault.
But my wife got me an iPad Pro 9.7-inch for a belated Father's Day gift.
Okay.
Which was completely unexpected, but very awesome. At the time, I was probably in your camp where it's like, I don't really need an iPad Pro. But once I had it and I started using it, I have noticed a couple things. So since you brought it up, I'll just, I'll tell you what I gleaned
from this. Because
you
got me curious
now. So I gleaned something in light of reading Deep Work by Cale Newport. So he talks in there about scheduling the offline blocks. And this is going completely out of order, so I apologize. But I have discovered that using the iPad Pro to do writing, I am actually a much faster writer on that device because I think the iOS, the operating system, provides constraints where I can't be distracted by other things. As long as I turn off the notifications, I don't have all these other things open in the background. You've really got, you can do split screen. So at most you've got two things up at once, but I've actually written several outlines and articles using the iPad Pro. I'll go down to the coffee shop because my office is upstairs right above a really nice coffee shop. So what I've been doing is when I need to write, I go down to the coffee shop and I can write consistently. Now I've done this like three or four times, about 1500 publishable words in about 45 minutes.
Nice.
Which is amazing compared to where I used to be. You know, I've mentioned before, I used to get up really early when I was working on my book and crank out 1,000 words before work, but a lot of those words never saw the light of day. This is totally different because I can go down there and everything just kind of flows, but then I get done and I'm like, hey, actually, this is pretty good. So it's a little bit different application of the scheduling the offline blocks, but I feel like I've been applying that principle even before. I really got the iPad Pro, like, I think, right after we recorded last time. So it's kind of before, but also during the reading and the application of what I've gotten from Deep Work. So
your wife didn't listen to
that. That's been
a really
interesting takeaway.
Your wife didn't listen to our episode, did she?
She did, just not before she bought it.
So here's a question for you then. So if the iPad Pro helps you write more because it's more focused, with your Mac setup, do you run multiple screens for that then?
I do. I have an external monitor that I plug into my MacBook Pro.
So you run the two side by side then?
Yeah, but I don't do that all the time. And to be honest, I probably don't use it the same way that a lot of people would use, like a multi-screen setup. Mm-hmm. Like right now, as we're recording, I've got Logic open on my MacBook screen just so I can make sure that everything looks good while we're recording and I don't hit any snags. I've also got Quip open, which has our notes to go off of. And then I've got a couple other things that I've actually gotten from the first time that I read Deep Work documented in an Omni Outliner file. So I have those two open on my main screen, Skype running in the background, but I don't have a bunch of things all lined up where I'm constantly switching between one and the next, like a lot of people do.
Yeah.
I tend to just focus in on the one screen. And if I have to have something up that I have to check occasionally, like, you know, for Asian efficiency, we use HipChat. I'll use HipChat. I'll leave that open on the second screen sometimes.
Yeah. Now, the reason I ask, because I went through this unintentional experiment of using nothing but a MacBook Pro screen for a year. And I can talk about this because I just wrote an article about it and it will come out shortly before this episode releases. So this will work out good. So it hasn't been released as we're recording this, but it will before you get a chance to listen to this. So for the listeners, it'll be in the show notes. But Mike, you can't read it yet. but I've been working solely off of a MacBook Pro and an iPhone. Like, those are my only devices. And I've been operating that way for a year, a little over a year now. But I, over time, I've realized that I have the same experience as what you're talking about with the iPad Pro, where if you just sit down, you only have access to a small portion of visibility on a screen, and that means that you end up being able to zone in on it, I guess would be the word for it. Does that make sense? Because it sounds like it's the same thing, but it's just a different device.
Yes, absolutely. Zoning in would be a great example or a great definition. I think maybe another way to describe it is, I mean, just going back to the title of the book, like it naturally facilitates deep work versus shallow work, where shallow work, you're kind of switching from one thing to the next and you're kind of scanning the horizon, where that setup forces you in one general direction with your work. Yes, you can go and switch to those other things, but when they're not all instantly accessible, it provides a little bit of friction where it kind of keeps you focused on the thing that you're supposed to be doing.
Interesting. Okay, well, I'm not going to keep going on this, but it's interesting that that worked out well, because I know that a lot of people talk about the benefits of having a specific device for a specific task, and it sounds like that's your iPad Pro.
Yeah, and it could be your MacBook too. You know, it really doesn't matter what the device is. The key is, and maybe this is just because of how I've used iOS versus macOS, I guess it's called now.
I know, I'm still trying to get my head around that.
I think part of it is I've learned some bad habits with macOS. I mean, I know that there's full screen built into a lot of applications now, but I just find right now the iOS constraints actually provide an atmosphere for me to do deep work better. And, you know, just jumping into the book, I guess, the definition of deep work that Cal Newport uses is professional activities performed in a state of distraction-free concentration that push your cognitive capabilities to their limit. These efforts create new value, improve your skill, and are hard to replicate. I think that as long as you are focusing on the professional activities, like the things that push your cognitive capabilities to their limit, then it doesn't really matter. You could set up whatever device you want to use the correct way, but for me, that's my iPad Pro. It provides the distraction-free atmosphere for me to do deep work more, I don't want to say effectively, but it's easier to click in, I guess.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That sounds, it's very similar to my writing desk that we've talked about in the past, where literally, it's not possible for distractions there because it's only pen and paper, and that's my only option. So my only, well, I guess my only potential distraction is to stare at the wall. That'd be fun. but yeah, so let's just go ahead and jump in here, Mike. So the book for today, because I think we're both really anxious to get into this, because we have a ton of notes on this one. I was looking through everything we have on this. It's like, is there anything in the book we didn't write down? So this might be a long episode. We'll see. But Deep Work by Cal Newport. This was my choice. And my primary reason for picking this is guilt. We were talking about Twitter earlier on, and this is one that it kind of made the rounds. You saw a lot of people for a while talking about it on Twitter. And I guess you still see some people starting to rave about it right now. But I saw a lot of the hype. It made me curious. A lot of people were talking about it, and I wanted to know what we were talking about. So thus, we've now read Deep Work, and I'm quite happy that we did.
Glad you gave in to internet peer pressure, huh?
I know. I know. It's crazy how the internet people can do that.
Yeah, this book is phenomenal. And I mentioned I read it previously, and it hit me so hard that I convinced Tan to let me do this, but we actually have a Deep Work webinar that we do for Asian efficiency.
Wow.
That I actually did it this week. We talk a lot about applying some of the strategies and principles that Cal talks about in the book. But yeah, this book is awesome.
It's been a long time, Mike, since I've run across a book that has single-handedly had this big of an impact on me. I think the last time it's hit me this hard would be Getting Things Done. The first time I went through it, where it just makes you stop and rethink everything. This, I think, does that for me, which is interesting because one of the first things that I ran across in the book was a conversation. It wasn't a conversation, but he was going through a study that talked about, and I'm going to have to look it up because I forget the guy's name. And there were some interesting names in this book that I had. I know you wrote one down for talking about it a little later. I want to hear you pronounce it. But he talks about, what's the guy's name? Grant. So Adam Grant. He's a professor at Wharton School of Business at Penn. And he developed this whole process of understanding how people are thinking and how they're working at a specific point. Anyway, long story short, he found out that some of the more effective people do work in batches. So they group similar tasks and work on them in those groupings, in those batches. And whenever I read that, I was like, well, that's getting things done. Like, that's, go clear back to episode one. That's where we started this whole journey. And the concept of batching tasks in order to accomplish more in a short amount of time. It's like, oh yeah, definitely. I've been doing that. This is how the book started, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm off to a good start here.
Yep, definitely. The batching task is really, it kind of ties into, I think he talks in the book, I think it's Attention Residue by Sophie Leroy, where a lot of times we don't recognize the switching tasks that are involved with the tasks that we've decided to do throughout the day. And she was a researcher, and the book is chock full of these references. She was a researcher, I think, at the University of Minnesota, who identified that when you switch from one task to another, that there is a residue of your attention that remains focused on the previous task. And then also in regards to switching, you need to make sure that you're focusing on the deep work, because the other finding she had was that if the work on the first task was unbounded or of low intensity, so i.e. checking email for a lot of people, then that is going to set you up to perform not as well on the next task. And batching kind of addresses that, where you can focus on related tasks and you can take advantage of the synergy that you get when you're already moving in a certain direction, and then you have all these things that are kind of on the periphery. You're already in that mindset. You're already in that mode. So it minimizes the amount of attention residue and the switching costs associated with going back and forth with those things.
Yeah, going off of that, there was one that was interesting because they made the correlation of, like you're saying, the attention residue. But what something I had never thought about, Mike, was how switching projects back and forth can have the same effect. Like, we all know, you know, multitasking doesn't actually work. Some of us like to claim that we're good at it and that we're able to do multiple things at one time. We all know you're false. You're lying. You're not actually that great at it. But it was interesting to me that there were the same effects that could happen if you move from one project to another. So I'm working on building out a website, and then I step over and go to recording a podcast, and then I'm going to step into designing a website for somebody. And if I do those three in succession, then I can very quickly and very easily have this lag between them and not actually get deep into a project, which means that I don't do as well on it as I could have if I was able to focus on it entirely. Does that make sense? Because it's effectively, it's detrimental in the same way that multitasking is, but when you're switching back and forth from projects.
Yes, that makes perfect sense. Now, one thing I'll throw out there is, it's a quote that I put in here that I really liked by Arnold Bennett, and I've experienced this myself. He said that one of the chief things which my typical man has to learn is that the mental faculties are capable of a continuous hard activity. They do not tire like an arm or a leg. All they want is change, not rest, except in sleep. So that is important because we tend to focus on, well, I'm going to do this thing. It's going to be really intense. I'm going to do deep work for a while, and then I got to take a break because I got to let myself recharge. And he's basically saying that that's not true. You can go head down into one website task and then switch to another very intense, deep work type task in a totally different arena, and your brain has no trouble keeping up with that. Now, sometimes there's little things that you can do to kind of facilitate the transition and to kind of get things moving again in the right direction. Like one experiment that I did a little bit ago was whenever I was feeling tired or drained in the middle of the day, I read this study that if you took a break and you did something that really just challenged you mentally, that it really like was an adrenaline shot, like a caffeine boost for your brain, so to speak. So one of the things that I did was I play guitar. I kept my guitar in my office, and whenever I felt like I just couldn't go anymore, I would hit that lull maybe in the middle of the afternoon. Instead of going and getting a coffee, I would pick up my guitar and I would play, and I would specifically try to write and create something, because the research that I had read backed this up, and I've noticed it in my own life that when I did that, even for a short period of time, like 10 to 15 minutes, it kind of pressed the reset button. And then after that, I could go and I could do something real intense and needed focus again. And I think that you could do that even without the mental interlude, I guess, of in my case, playing guitar. I think that you could, you know, if you're going to work real hard on writing an article or developing a site or whatever, like you can be head down in that code for a long time. And then when you hit a wall, all you've got to do is switch the deep work task that you want to do. And you'll find that you're able to hit the ground running, and there's efficiency in the work that you're doing for the new task. At least that's my experience.
Yeah, I think that makes sense to a point, because I know that for me, it's almost similar to if I was working on coding a website or building a web application, and then I just got burnt out on it and then went to write a blog post, because that would be kind of a creative, difficult endeavor, depending on the topic for the article, and then coming back to do the development. But in my case, that wouldn't work. Like, I just know that it would just continue to drain, because for some reason, maybe it's the same side of creativity. I don't know. But there's something going on, at least in my mind, that doesn't let me do that. But this is the thing. Whenever I went through this, it challenged my thinking on that, because previously I've always thought about whenever I have those walls, like you hit the wall and you just don't want to keep going, that I would try to find some way to take a short 5-10 minute break, go for a walk, brainstorm something and see if I could hit that reset button, like what you're saying. And whenever I would do that, I would step away from the thing I'm doing and hope that it could recharge. And it sometimes worked, it sometimes didn't. But Cal Newport challenges the idea that you would need to go do a reset. At least that's the way I took it, Mike, because mm-hmm. it meant that I could work those muscles in my brain to get to a point where they could handle longer periods of challenging and mentally draining work, which can come back to the willpower instinct with how do you go about building the muscle of your brain, and how do you go about getting better at the things that you're doing and continue to develop your ability to do the hard stuff, I guess. And, you know, you can start to tie a lot of these books together with how do you get past the resistance to start, and how do you go about continuing to work on it? And I think Cal Newport, he talks a lot about how to continue doing the hard stuff, how to continue doing that deep work when you feel like you're done. And I feel like I'm just belaboring this at the moment, but it's the idea that you can push through some of those walls. And a lot of the stuff that we've learned to this point with Bookworm can show you that there are ways to get past that wall.
Yes, the walls are, I don't want to say artificial, but you can develop your focus muscle, I would argue, to the point where you don't hit those, at least at the point where you would typically hit them anymore. At least that's my experience, and I guess that's coming from, you know, somebody who was working a 40-hour a week day job and was trying to write on the side and squeeze in some stuff for Asian Efficiency, which looking back at it now, maybe I was trying to do too much at that time, but what it built up, the positive from that was that I would argue it developed the ability for me to enter in and do deep work using the journalistic approach that he talked about. We can dive into the approaches in a little bit, but every time that you do that, I think you flex that focus muscle, deep work gets a little bit easier, and then you can do it a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And if you keep doing it consistently, that was one of the things that he was talking about in the book, was that you need to do these things consistently and you'll leverage the compound effect to produce substantial results if you're just consistent with it. You can't just do it once and say, oh, that was hard, but there I did it, now I'm good for a week. You have to consistently do it. But as long as you do that, I think that the average person can overcome those obstacles that, again, they're not artificial, but they're almost like mental. You have to get to a point where you see that you are able to overcome them. And then once you see that, yeah, I can beat this thing, then it usually isn't very long until that breakthrough or that victory comes.
I know,
but getting over that initial hump where it's like, yes, I can do this, that's the hard part.
I know. And this is, so right now, the project I'm working on is working with OmniFocus, which is, that's the book I wrote, but I'm transforming it into a video series. So I'm going through the process of creating screencasts that emulate a lot of what's in the book. So it puts a video to what you're doing. So for me, there's a lot of interesting things with that and the whole process that goes with developing a screencast. Well, what I found, Mike, was there's a lot of instances where I just don't want to, sit down and turn on the camera. I don't want to sit and turn on the microphone and go. It's just something that I just, for whatever reason, it's hard to get myself going on it, or I'm at it for a while and I'm just like, okay, I'm just done. And something about that has shown me that even though I don't want to keep going, there are some little things that I can do to spark me to keep going. And then it somehow perpetuates. And honestly, if you're reading this book, something I found, if you're in the middle of reading this, the book itself is motivation to keep working.
Right.
And to develop the deeper levels of work that you're going to do, because you're sitting here reading it and it's like, you know, he's a great author and he's telling you these stories of people who are able to spend all this time in isolation or away from the distractions in order to develop some pretty sophisticated and interesting things. And whenever you hear those stories, it's like, okay, well, I could do that. I can keep going. I can keep this stuff mm-hmm. moving. And when it's all said and done, you end up, you yourself end up producing more and feel a lot better about it.
Yes, you're more satisfied. And that's where the Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi stuff comes in.
I was going to say, yeah, you're going to pronounce that.
I only know that because I looked up the pronunciation of it. So hopefully I got it right. But he talks a lot about flow, which, you know, people might describe as getting in the zone. Cal Newport would describe it as deep work. But he's been doing this research since the 70s or the 80s. And basically his research indicates that what people really want, according to all the research that he's done, is not an easy life, but a fulfilling life. And I think that's a really important distinction, because a lot of people think, like going back to what we talked about last time, the if-then mindset. If I can get to this point, then I'll just be able to take it easy. I'll be able to coast. I don't have to worry about all this stuff anymore. That actually doesn't bring the satisfaction that you think it will. But if you're able to apply the deep work principles, if you're able to enter into what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi would call flow, then that is going to translate into happiness, satisfaction in both your personal and your professional life. So when you go into a job interview, for example, the first question that you usually ask is, how much does it pay? Because you think that if you're compensated accordingly, then everything's going to be great. You're going to love what you do. That's not the case. Better question would be, am I going to be able to do deep work here? Or am I going to be stuck responding to what other people are declaring as urgent? Am I going to be stuck responding to email for 8 hours a day? You know, am I going to be able to enter in and focus everything that I have, all my cognitive abilities, on what I'm going to be doing? And it doesn't even matter what that thing is. It doesn't have to be designing a logo or developing a website. I mean, you have in the notes here from the book, the craftsman mindset, like he talks about a blacksmith and a wheel, forget what the term is, but somebody who makes wagon wheels. These are jobs that still exist, even though those technologies are completely obsolete for the most part. Like, no one's buying antique Viking swords anymore, except as collector's items. But there's this guy in Wisconsin who, this is what he does. And he's so passionate about it because it's really, really hard. And he's able to focus on it and produce something that when he's done, even though it's difficult, he looks at it and he's like, yes, I have accomplished something. I've done something great. And he feels satisfied.
This is where it gets hard for knowledge workers, because you brought up the blacksmithing mindset and how they go about doing things. Well, they build things with their hands. Like I think about this whenever I go out to my wood shop and I build something, like a piece of furniture of some kind. I go out there, and some people in the GTD world get upset at me because I don't really keep a task list on the stuff I'm building out there. And the reason is I can go out to the wood shop, and in 10 seconds, I can tell you what the next step is that needs to be done just by looking at the piece that I'm working on. And it has nothing to do with a need to keep track of all the stuff that I'm working on. It has a lot to do with being able to see what comes next, because it's a physical thing that you're working on. You can physically see what you're doing. And when you have the ability to just look at it and know what you're doing, then it's just simple. And when you're done, you have something you can put in your hands. You can go put it in the house. You have the ability to look at something and say, I made that. There's pride in that. There's satisfaction in saying, look what I made. I mean, you can do that. With, say, I'm building a website, or I figured out something that a client wanted to learn about and I was able to generate a report for that. If I do those things, if I close the computer, it's gone. You can't see it anymore. It's not something right. that you're going to be able to say, look what I did. It's not in front of you. So you have to develop a mindset that helps you to understand how that satisfaction comes about. I'm not sure I fully figured it out, Mike. I thought it was, he made some really good points, but it's one of those things that I think I get it, but it's going to take me a little while to get my head around it and just wrestle with it in order to fully understand it well enough to say, hey, yeah, I've got satisfaction in building those websites versus the same satisfaction that can come from opening the drawer to a dresser that I built. Does that make sense? Because it's the difference between being able to put your hands on it and see it versus closing the computer and it's gone.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, you're not going to have a physical, tangible thing that you can pick up when you're done with your knowledge work for the day. But I think the important thing is, you know, going back to Ryan Holiday, the obstacle is the way. It's not so much the end result, but it's the journey that's important. There's a quote actually by the blacksmith guy in Deep Work. He says, to do it right, it is the most complicated thing I know how to make. And it's that challenge that drives me. I don't need a sword, but I have to make them. And I think that mindset can definitely be applied to knowledge work as well. Whether you're creating videos in my case, or writing blog posts, or creating a website, you know, writing code, there's a lot of different avenues that approach could take, but the result is the same. The joy comes from the journey.
One of the things that he talks about in the book, they are philosophies of deep work. I thought these were really interesting, because when I started it, I was thinking he was going to give us, you know, this is how you come about doing deep work. But then he presented these four philosophies. I'm just going to work through these, and then I think we should share the ones that we picked, because I'm sure you already know which one you're going to fall into, would be my guess. I think there was four. So three?
Yep.
Three or four?
No, there's four. I know these inside and out because I present them in the
webinar. Oh, you want to go? You want to do this? You want to
sure.
do it?
Yeah, I can lead them. The first one is the monastic approach, and this I think is what most people think of when they think of deep work, because they think of the person who just disappears for a while they focus on their big project, and then they reappear 6 months later, and they've got their book or they've got their created thing. that is going to be by far the hardest one for anybody that I know to apply. And I think it's actually pretty impossible for a lot of people. But he does give some examples of people who have done that in the book.
I will say that going through that one, I was sitting here thinking, man, that'd be really cool to just, I'm going to go do this for 4 months and just be done with it. But I couldn't do it. I want to, but there's no way I could do it.
Yeah. And then the second one is probably the more approachable one for somebody like you who wants to embrace that approach. And I agree, it does sound pretty awesome sometimes, but that's going to be impossible. Then the second one is maybe feasible, and that is the bimodal approach. And so in the bimodal approach, what you're doing is you are splitting your weeks and months into the deep and shallow. And because you're differentiating them on large chunks of time like that, you're able to go off the grid for a little bit and get some really solid deep work done, but you're not gone long enough to really be completely disconnected from everything. And he uses an example in the book that I absolutely love of J.K. Rowling. Do you remember that one?
I do.
Okay, so yeah, I did a little bit more research on the story. When she wrote the first Harry Potter book, she wrote it on a manual typewriter as a single mother, and she submitted it, and it was rejected 12 times. Okay, so you really have to understand that this was not just a one-time event for her to go do this deep work. That she had been cultivating this approach to deep work, what not necessarily the bimodal approach, but that the prioritization of deep work for a long time. Because by the time she got to this book, I think this is the Deathly Hallows example.
Yeah, yeah.
She was basically in an environment where it just wasn't going to happen. She was at home, her kids were going crazy, her dogs were barking, the window cleaner was coming, and she's just like, "There's no way I'm going to finish this here." So what she did is she rented a room at the Balmoral in Edinburgh, I believe, which is pretty nice hotel, actually very close to where she got the inspiration for Hogwarts, part of the Harry Potter's series. And she didn't just rent a room. She rented like the penthouse suite. So it was really expensive. And I think that's the key part there that makes it bimodal, is that this was not a large amount of time. There was significant pain for every day that she was still there writing that book. And also, I would argue she could not just walk away from her family. But what she did is she put herself in a position where she could stack her time and she could focus and prioritize finishing the book.
See, I think that's brilliant and at the same time scary.
Yes, definitely.
Like, if you... And I think he had a term for it. It was something about how much you put a lot into it. It's like you put in a financial or a time element that costs you significantly in order to force you to spend more time with it.
Yes, he called it the grand gesture.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and so it doesn't have to be, you know, thousands of dollars and weeks worth of time away from your family, but the taking a step out like that and saying, drawing a clear line in the sand, a public line in the sand, is even better. That accountability, that built-in accountability, is often the kick in the pants that we need to actually follow through and do the deep work. That's the idea behind the grand gesture.
So we have monastic, we have bimodal, and then what is it, rhythmic?
Yes, rhythmic. And so this is kind of just splitting your time into the deep and the shallow on a day-by-day basis. So I think this is really effective because you can actually build up a natural cadence where you sprint and then you recover. So an example of this might be, you know, you might make Mondays your creative days or Fridays your admin days, kind of theming your days and then batching your tasks like you were talking about along those themes. So you know that at the beginning of the week when I'm coming off the weekend and I'm fresh, that's when I'm going to try to produce a lot of videos that day because I know I've got the most resources, most gas in my tank to actually get stuff done.
I think isn't it Mike Vardy who does that? He's very public about it. He's got different activities are done on different days for him. So he does have like an admin day. He has a dad day. He's got a writing day, I believe, and I forget what all he has, but he's been talking about that for years, as far as I can recall.
Yep. Yeah, and I actually, we do that too. We theme our days like that. We have the New Year calendar that he talks about.
Oh, right, right.
The NEU year calendar, where you see the whole 12 months at one time. And that is pretty effective. And this is also pretty achievable, especially for knowledge workers, where if you can control your own schedule to any sort of degree where you're not going into an office and you're not at the mercy of your superiors who are going to call meetings and say, you got to be there right now, then you can implement this. This is pretty achievable. And I would say that this is the level that pretty much everybody should at least shoot for.
So I will say that the rhythmic philosophy, so you've got the little bit every day, or you've got your different days and stuff. This is the one I'm falling into. This is easily the one I'm choosing in this whole process, because it's easier for me to just maintain the same routine every single day. I just know that. I operate a lot better at that. So the way I've been coming at it, Mike, is as far as a deep work schedule goes, for me, I try to make sure that I capture my entire morning. And that's every single day. Every day I'm going to go to work, it's always in the morning. And I can't say that I've done it for a long time, but I've done something similar for a long time, where I've spent at least an hour or so in the morning writing. And I think a lot of writers talk about that, where you need to spend a certain amount of time every single day. You'll see some people say, well, I got my 1,000 words in today. Like, you'll see that stuff make the rounds on social media occasionally. And there's a lot of power in that. And I think Cal would jump on board and say, yeah, that's a great thing, because it does fall into this rhythmic scheduling. And whenever you sit down to do the thing and you're so used to doing it every single day, your mind just immediately shifts into that mode and you're off to the races.
I agree. I would also say, though, that because you are a parent and I am a parent, I would say that sometimes you may have every intention of embracing a rhythmic approach and you're stuck with number four, which is the journalistic approach, where you're quickly flipping back and forth between deep and shallow whenever you can fit a block of time in. And this is probably where I started. I took a look at my schedule, and I saw that the only time that I was going to get to not be interrupted was at 5 a.m. So I started getting up early and writing, 1,000 words a day was my goal before I went into the office. And that has kind of led to the point where I am now, where I can basically embrace a rhythmic approach for the most part. But there are going to be times when I am going to switch back into journalistic. And then there are also times when I would argue I will actually embrace bimodal as well. So for example, last year we went on a family vacation for 2 weeks. We went up to Minocqua, Wisconsin, which is this lake town. There's a couple coffee shops up there, and I was in the process of writing my book. It wasn't happening as quickly as I wanted it to, and my wife and I came to the agreement that I was going to get up early, go to the coffee shop, and basically work for like 5 hours before lunch and get writing done. And I did that for 2 weeks, and pretty much all of the content for my book came out of that 2 week
nice
bimodal period. So it's not like you have to choose one of these and then, okay, I'm going to do this now for the next 6 months. I think you can kind of switch these up and embrace these on a day-to-day or even hour-by-hour basis. And you can do, for the most part, rhythmic, and then in the middle of your rhythm, you get interrupted, whatever, you switch into journalistic. It's really just the focal point of looking for the place and the time to do that deep work using what he calls fixed schedule productivity. You can take your calendar, your schedule, and you can identify, looking at that calendar or that schedule, where you're going to do your deep work, but it does all need to take place inside of that context of time. So I really do like that part of the book where he talks about the fixed schedule productivity and how he takes a look at his calendar and he creates the hour blocks, and he lines them all up, and he basically schedules every single minute of his day. That's one of my takeaways. I want to start doing that. And it doesn't always have to be deep work activities. You can actually schedule rest or play or whatever, but making sure that all of that stuff that is important for you to do gets on the calendar.
Yeah, and I can tell you that works really well. I've been doing that for 3-4 months now. I watched a webinar by Sean Blanc. He's been doing it for a while, and I took away from that 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 was something I wanted to try. So I started, I have a notebook here sitting next to me, and I've got the hours from 6 in the morning until 9 at night, and every single hour in between there, and then every hour is accounted for. And I can see right now, as I'm looking at my schedule for the day, I'm supposed to be recording Bookworm right now. So I think I'm on schedule for the day. But I know exactly what comes after this, and I know what time the day ends. And as long as I follow that schedule, at the end of the day, if I followed that, then it's like, oh, yes, I hit exactly what I wanted to do. And whenever you do that, if you plan it out and you're trying to be as smart with it as you can, it's like, yes, I'm finally making great progress. But of course, kids, you fall off that schedule occasionally and you just readjust. But honestly, just having it on paper, I don't know why, but that's freeing. I've tried to do this with a digital calendar, but it's not the same. It doesn't work the same. I don't know how many different versions of digital calendars I've tried with this, and it just doesn't work.
That's interesting, because I was definitely going to take a digital approach. I've actually created already a Canvas calendar where I can use that to kind of block out all the different time frames where I'm going to be doing things. It's not going to have all the individual appointments on there, but I'll be able to just look at that one digital calendar and get an overview of like, okay, from this time I'm going to be here, from this time I'm going to be here doing this, and even differentiating it not just based on physical location, but also just the mindset that I want to apply there. I'll have to, I guess, report back on whether my digital experiment.
Yeah, I
want
to know. I want to know if that works, because I tried digital multiple times, and it was almost like I didn't trust it for some reason, and I don't know why, Mike. It never fully made sense to me. I tried it multiple times, and you would think I'm a digital person. I should be able to pull this off. And I always found that if I wrote it on paper, I was more apt to actually follow through with it, as opposed to if it's on the digital calendar, for some reason, I would sometimes just not pay any attention to it. And I wouldn't realize I was doing that until a couple hours later. And then it's too late.
That's interesting. Yeah, I'll have to report back on that.
I hope it works for you.
me too. One other thing I want to touch on, talking about the different approaches, is the deep work formula, which really this kind of crystallized in my mind that any one of these approaches is not necessarily better than the others. It's really not like if you're listening to this right now and you're like, oh, deep work sounds awesome. I read the book. There's all these benefits. Sign me up. But I just can't do it. You can do it. You don't have to devote 40 hours a week to deep work in order to get the benefits that Cal talks about in the book. The formula for deep work is time spent times intensity of focus. So all you really need to do is whatever amount of time you have to devote to deep work, whether it is 15 minutes or 40 hours a week, just dive in as deep as you can. You can maximize your results by maximizing your intensity, even if it's just embracing the journalistic approach here and there. And then just by doing that, you make it easier to do more deep work in the future. One of the things he talks about, which I really, really liked, was the what happens in your brain when you do deep work. He talks about how when you do deep work, your brain produces myelin, which is the fatty tissue that grows around the neurons. And that actually causes the cells to fire faster and cleaner. So when you're trying to learn something new or you're working deep, then you actually cement that skill. And when you're practicing something without focusing like that, it's actually harder to isolate these neurons that you actually want to strengthen. So learning, the ability to learn is key. Learning is an act of deep work.
Now, one of the things I know he talks about, because so we go through the philosophies. One of the things he helps you figure out is what should you be working on? What is the deep work you should be focusing on? I was very glad he did that. it's like, okay, so I could set aside, I can schedule it. I know my philosophy behind it. What do I do? that was kind of where I was at with it. But he took you through this process of determining what he calls wildly important goals. And the thing I took away from that is you want to nail down as few as you can get away with, preferably one goal that you're going to shoot for. And that's the thing that you work towards whenever you when you sit down to do the deep work. For me, it was pretty easy whenever I went through that of what should my wildly important goal be, because that's the course, the video series for OmniFocus. And that just means that whenever I go to sit down to do deep work, that is the one and only thing I have to do, because it gets away from the attention residue thing we were talking about earlier with the shifting projects back and forth. Oh man, I've been bad at that in the past where I'd sit down and I was like, okay, I've got a 3-hour block. For 30 minutes, I'm going to write an article. For 45, I'm going to work on the design for this new website. And then I'm going to spend an hour working on this other code project that I've got going on. And just shifting back and forth between them just became a nightmare. But whenever I have a single thing I'm working towards, oh man, it gets easy. At least for me, it felt super easy because I know this is the one and only thing I have that's important for me to work towards.
And I have a little bit of trouble with that because I find that I am balancing different responsibilities. So it's hard for me to say this is the one thing that is the most important over everything else. Although there's definitely benefit in taking that approach. There's an entire book written on that called The One Thing.
Right.
Which is a great book. Maybe we cover that one at some point.
There you go.
But for example, right now I've got the focus with Asian efficiency is, and this is not a secret, so I can talk about this, but we're working on a new product around email, actually. So I'm laser focused as product
director.
You need
a beta
tester? Yeah, maybe. So I'm laser focused whenever I'm working on Asian efficiency stuff, that is, on completing that course as product director. That's my baby. But also, as we record this, tomorrow we have a big men's rally that we're having at our church. And as the coordinator of our men's ministry, that is also something that is very, very important. So I have to balance these responsibilities, and I think it's okay. I think it's all right to say during this time block, these 2 hours where I'm going to go deep on whatever task, that task is the one thing that I work on. But it is okay throughout the course of a day. Hopefully, I'm putting words in Kel Newport's mouth, so hopefully
we won't tell him this.
But I believe that it's okay to do that. For the key is that when you're going to whatever time you're going to devote to deep work, you have one thing that you're working on. You're not bouncing back and forth. But it's okay throughout the course of a day to say, okay, these 2 hours are going to be deep work over here, and then the next 2 hours I'm going to do deep work on this other thing. Because that kind of goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, that quote I shared with Arnold Bennett, where sometimes that actually is an efficiency mechanism where you go till you can't go anymore on this one task, you get stuck, and then you switch tasks, and your brain doesn't care that it's hard because your brain doesn't physically get tired like an arm or a leg, as he said, but or the ability to really dive in deep and do deep work doesn't get tired. I mean, obviously, there's limits to your willpower and stuff like that. But those kinds of things can actually spur creativity and deep work and focus on a different task when you switch like that. You just have to switch the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that has a lot to do with, like we were talking earlier, with theming days. Like if you had one day for this one and one day for that one, I think that would help. Or even like morning and afternoon. But like the jumping back and forth, I think, is where it gets in trouble.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree with that. But even when you have to jump back and forth, because there are things that will come up, especially if you work with other people, there will be quote-unquote emergencies that you have to deal with. And I guess just from my experience, no scientific research behind this, but I would say that it has gotten easier for me to go deal with a fire and then come back and do deep work just because I have prioritized deep work. I'm looking for the places to do deep work. And I think that's really important. And in fact, in the book, he gives the definitions of deep work versus shallow work. And I kind of shared the one about deep work already, but you know, just for review, I guess. Deep work are professional activities performed in a state of distraction-free concentration that push your cognitive capabilities to their limit. These efforts create new value, they improve your skill, and they're hard to replicate. Versus shallow work, and this is what people, I think, tend to gravitate towards just because of the any benefit approach, which I know you've got in the outline there. Shallow work is not cognitively demanding. They're logistical style tasks, which are often performed while you're distracted. And these efforts tend not to create much new value in the world and are easy to replicate. I think as long as you can identify deep work, look to do deep work and make it a priority, then you're on the right path.
So part of the shallow work piece that he talks about, because, okay, we just need to jump into social media here. so obviously, I think whenever you look at those definitions, the vast majority of us are going to say that social media will fall into that shallow work category. If you're a social media manager, it's probably going to be your deep work to figure out your strategies and how you're going to use social media. But the vast majority of people, it doesn't fall into that category. And this is something, you know, you mentioned the any benefit bias. So what that essentially means is in our society, in our culture, in the world we live in with technology and the ultra connectivity that we have with everybody else in the world, we tend to come at things with the mindset that if a tool offers any sort of benefit at all to the business or the work that you're doing, if it has, you know, take social media for an example here, if Twitter has the ability to drive people to my blog in any capacity, whether it's one click, two clicks, 1,000 clicks, doesn't matter. If it has any capacity to bring them to my site, then I need to use it. I've heard a few people in the blogosphere who will talk about jumping onto any and every social media network there is. And whenever they do that, they're essentially fragmenting their attention across all kinds of social media sites, which is fine if you want to do that. But ultimately, what he's saying is whenever you're jumping into all of those, you're doing it because you think there's at least some benefit. And even though there's some benefit, the question that he has is, if it, even though it has some benefit, it may not necessarily be vital or ultimately beneficial to what you're doing, because there are negatives that are going to come with it, and you have to weigh the positives against the negatives in order to come out with your decision. And whenever you look at something like social media, take Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, the vast majority of the instances that we use those in, there are a significant number of negatives, primarily in attention and time, that we need to devote to those, that even though we're giving it that amount of time, we're not getting a whole lot in return from that. So his question then is, well, if there are more negatives than there are positives, should you be using that tool at all? And that led me down this whole path of, okay, do I reevaluate all this stuff? And should I be using certain ones? How much should I be using them? How many do you use? It makes you question a lot of things. And thankfully, I'm not one that jumps into the mindset of I need to have all of them. I tend to just say, okay, mm-hmm. Twitter's kind of my space. But what I'm going to jump into action items here. One of the things that I run is I have a discussion site that sits behind my blog. It's what runs the comment structure on my site. So yes, there's comments, but there's a full-on discussion software called Discourse that runs behind all of that. So it's what embeds the topics into each article. And you have the ability to create topics that are outside of those comments. So it kind of creates this whole community behind the scenes, which is a lot of fun. We have a lot of interesting conversations over there. But what I've learned through this process is that's where I need to be spending a lot of my time, Mike, because I can spend a lot of time on Twitter. I can spend a lot of time on Instagram. And there are various others, you know, GitHub kind of floats out there for me as well. But ultimately, I need to be more focused on that discussion site as opposed to the social media sites. And that really pains me to say that.
Yeah, you've embraced the craftsman approach to tool selection, as Cal calls it, which is adopting a tool only if it takes positive or makes positive impacts on the core factors that determine success in your personal and professional life, substantially outweighing the negative. The whole idea behind the any benefit approach is that we justify our use of these things because there is some benefit. But I forget who said it. There's a quote that says, good is the enemy of the best, because if we focus on the things that are good, we'll justify our focus on those things, and we will completely miss the things that are really the best thing for us. And that, if you decide to use social media, that's okay. You just have to take into account the whole picture. You have to look at all the pros and all the cons and really decide, is this something that is really going to be beneficial to me? And for me personally, I really like Twitter. I got my current position with Asian Efficiency through Twitter, actually. But I am hardly ever on Facebook. And I probably will never really be on Facebook other than to check in once in a while and maintain contact with some family members. That's the only social media network that they're on. And I guess just a little bit of a bunny trail here. The difference between Facebook and Twitter in my mind is that Facebook, because it's all based on, I want to add you as a friend and someone has to reciprocate, it's all based on who you used to know, which for me means a lot of people that I went to high school with that, to be honest, I don't really want to surround myself with those people anymore. John Lee Dumas talks all the time about how you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. And when you're spending time on social media and you're surrounding yourself with those voices, those are people who are speaking into your life. Whereas Twitter, there's not that reciprocal follow aspect to it. So you can actually follow the people who you want to surround yourself with. So Twitter is kind of like who you want to know. And that's how I got the job at Asian Efficiency. I was following these people who I classified as my internet heroes. So Joe was on that list. Tan was on that list. Mike Vardy, a lot of the people that we've talked about who now are kind of my quote unquote contemporaries, not trying to put myself on the same level as some of those people necessarily, but I am part of that community now. And that would have never happened if I would have constantly been looking backwards. I had to look forward and talk and focus on like who I wanted to become. So a little bit of a diversion from the any benefit approach, but really it's just an example, I guess, of that. I believe anyway, social media isn't necessarily bad, and you don't have to be a social media manager in order to get significant benefit from those avenues and those communities, those communication channels. But you do need to take into account how many of these things you're going to check on a regular basis. And you do have to call and curate the ones that really aren't bringing you the value that you really need to. You can't justify them by embracing that any benefit approach. You really have to make sure that everything that's there is essential.
And I think that Twitter is kind of it's a tricky one for folks in the business that we're in, because it can bring a lot of very good opportunities, and it has for me as well. But honestly, if I stop and think about it, the ones that really matter, the opportunities that have really gotten me somewhere, a lot of those have come through email, which might explain why I'm addicted to email. Like, I don't check it constantly, but it's one where and we've talked about this, I've been in trouble the last two episodes, but the main thing for me is that a lot of great opportunities for me have come through email. Now, I've taken it as an action item on the last two. Is it the last two that we've talked about this? So the last two, I think it's the last two. The last two shows.
Yep.
I've been trying to figure out how I was going to do this, and Cal has almost a whole chapter on email in here, and he has a ton of tips that are extremely helpful, especially for me, that I have been working to implement, and I actually already did this on my site. So even as we're recording this, this is already done, but I have pulled my email address off a lot of places. I put together something like what Cal calls a sender filter. So there's a series of questions if you go to the contact page on my site that it's It's like, okay, if your request is this, post it here. If it's this, go here. If it's this, go to Google. If it's this, okay, I guess you can fill out the form below. But don't expect a response because I'm not going to respond to everything. So I did go through and do all of that to try to help with the inputs and the massive email that I do get. And even since I've put that in place, my email count has gone down drastically. And even the ones that I get, I don't feel the pressure to have to respond to everything. So I can say this does work very well for somebody that's in my type of role, because so much of what I do is based on what's in my head and what I go to work on. So I'm not really dependent, at least very much, about the other people that I'm working with. There's some of that with clients, but I've got a separate sort of email system that works for that, that I make sure that those are called out. So I never miss those. But the massive people who run across me through the site, those I need to filter a lot more. And that's what I've been working on and doing. And it's been very successful for me, even in the short amount of time that I've put it in place. But he has a ton of tips on how to respond to email, how to think about it. He even has this whole framework on how to craft a response or to write an email that says, okay, this is what's going to happen. This is what you can expect. If you reply to this, I'll take that as a confirmation. And it's like this very formal, almost robotic form of this is how you write the email. And the whole point of that is to eliminate the number of responses you get back, because as we all know, the more you send, the more you receive. So if you can craft it such that you don't need to send another email once it comes back, then you don't have to worry about getting more, which is a very good thing when you're getting hundreds a day.
Yeah, here's the key though, is that you could get 1,000 email messages a day, and if you're just okay with not getting back to those people, hitting, you know, selecting all those messages, hitting delete, then that's a perfectly acceptable email system. That's kind of what Sean Blanc does. He's talking about how he spends a half hour a day dealing with email, and he gets more than a half hour's worth of email every day. So he replies to he cherry picks the ones he wants to reply to.
Right.
And then basically just archives everything else. So you can do that, but I think you're kind of like me where you don't like doing that. You want to make sure that you have a system in place where you can filter out the things that are truly important, and everything that you're talking about, those checks on the front, that will eliminate a lot of email you have to deal with. So I think that's definitely a great first step. But really the thing that we have to overcome is the ability to sit. What we have to develop is the ability to say no to stuff. We have to overcome the fear of missing out. And a lot of times we say yes to those opportunities because we don't want to miss out on maybe that opportunity has something valuable for us. He describes this approach with email specifically as a culture of connectivity in the book. And he says that a culture of connectivity is easier because you don't have to plan ahead. You can run your day out of your inbox. The problem with this is obviously that you're working according to what other people are saying is important, unless you develop enough of a backbone to say, no, what you're telling me to do actually isn't important. I've defined something else as important, but you will tick some people off, whether you're putting extra checkboxes on the front of your contact form, or you're ignoring email, or you're replying and saying, nope, sorry, not going to do this. Like, you have to be okay with that. That's a key tipping point, I think, for really being able to focus in and do deep work on the things that truly are important.
Yeah, I know one of the quotes that I wrote down for that he put in the book was, the world represented by your inbox, in other words, isn't a pleasant world to inhabit, which I would totally agree with, because the vast majority of them are, and you know, one of the things I had to put on my contact form, and it's almost sad that I had to do this, but it simply states that if your question is a technical question and you haven't searched Google for at least 10 minutes, then you don't need to respond. Like, ghost check Google first. But I get a ton of email from people that, how do I install an Apple script in OmniFocus? Like, how many times have I had to answer this? It's even out on my site on how to do this. But people don't search for things. They would rather send an email than to search for it. So I actually had to put that on there because I get so many of these technical questions, and it's out there. So go search for it first.
Yep, definitely. One other thing I want to hit on, because you had it on your list here. I know we're going long, but I've actually been implementing this, is the productive meditation.
Right, right.
So not to completely switch topics on you, but I want to make sure we get this in.
No, fine.
Productive meditation is awesome. And so my application of this is basically I will be working on a task, and whenever I am stuck on a task where I just, like, specifically with this product that we're creating, I'm creating these outlines for the different videos. And frequently what I will do is I will take my dog for a walk. And usually in the past, what I would do in that scenario is I'd put my Bluetooth on and I would either listen to a podcast or an audiobook. I'd always be consuming some sort of content. But the productive meditation that he talks about is where you go on a walk, for example, you change your environment, you get moving a little bit, and you just think about the problem. And that is really effective. I've found that as I'm walking my dog, I usually have my iPhone with me. And as I'm thinking about things, I'm like, oh yeah, that's a really great idea. Then I'll go ahead and capture that in drafts. But I have been able to create outlines specifically much more quickly using that method than if I'm sitting down, even if I've got my focus music playing through my headphones, my noise canceling headphones. Like, I have the atmosphere set up where I should be able to do deep work, but just getting out and walking the dog and just thinking about the problem actually has brought a lot of solutions and a lot of clarity to some things that I've had to work on. So that's my experience with productive meditation.
When I read this, my first thought was, is this weird? Like, is this abnormal? That was my first thought, because to me, this is just, maybe I'm just really weird. Mike, don't tell my wife I'm admitting that. But I have been doing this process for years and didn't know it. Because for such a long time, I've known I have a race car brain. Some people like to call it ADHD. I just like calling it a race car brain. And it's this, to me, it's the same thing. And I've gotten to a point where it might be to where I jump from topic to topic, but so much of the time I have a solution or a problem I'm trying to solve, and I'm just interested in it enough that I just keep pummeling at it and keep working at it until I have a solution nailed down. But I've been doing that for at least 2.5 to 3 years, I know, where a solution or a problem would come up. I'm mowing the yard, and I'm thinking about it the whole time I'm mowing, and it's like an hour and a half time that I'm mowing, and I'm just going to think about this problem the whole time until I have a solution to it. And then when I'm done, I know that whenever I have a period of time that I'm doing something like that, I just go, and like in that case, I'm going to go take a shower, but while I'm cooling down, I'm going to write down all of the notes that I have for that thing so I don't forget it, and then I'll take a shower. And I've been doing that for a long time, and I can honestly say this thing is amazing, but again, I didn't know it was weird, Mike. I didn't know it was not normal.
Yep. I definitely agree. Not that you're weird, but that it does work.
So it's one of those things that I realize I've been doing for a long time, but because I now understand it more, it's the same thing. Like, once you learn more about something, you're either going to run away from it because you know too much about it, or you run towards it because you understand it more fully and you want to take advantage of it. So I think in this case, it's the case where I want to run towards it and do it more because I understand it more fully.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And that's kind of the result, I think, of how Cal writes the book. I mean, kind of going out of order, but you talk about how you get the explanation, the way that Cal explains it, and it's like, yeah, that makes sense. I'm going to continue to do this. I got that with just about everything that he wrote in this book,
right?
Honestly. I put for the author's style that it's very academic, but it's not unapproachable. Very, very well researched and supported. Everything that he shares is very well documented. It's got an easy and engaging writing style. And then reading it actually makes you feel smarter, because Cal's brilliant. He's done a lot of the work here, but you feel like you understand everything that he's telling you because he explains it so well. And then because of that, you're like, yeah, I got to do this more because this just makes perfect sense.
Right. Absolutely. And the more time I spent understanding him, the more I wanted to go create my own stuff. And we've talked about this in the past. I dive into studies occasionally. I didn't even look one up on this. He has, if you go to the back, he has citation after citation. Like, there are hundreds of these things.
Yeah.
Like, even simple stuff, like where he ran across a phrase, he has it cited as, I found this on Twitter from this person, and this was in an article from 14 years ago. And it's, where on earth did you come up with all this? But so there was no way I was going to dive into it. I figured he easily knows. He's easily got it all figured out. So I didn't even attempt to look into things. But he explains things very well. And a lot of times I criticize authors for going too long and belaboring a topic and just going too, like, reiterating it too much. And I feel like Cal had so much information that he wanted to cover that he never crossed a topic twice, ever. And that, I think, is one, rare. Usually somebody will reiterate a topic somewhere along the lines in order to prove a point. But I didn't run across that here at all, that I remember anyway. I didn't notice it if he did, which tells me he's a really good writer. But just the fact that he's writing about deep work immediately gives him credibility, because you know he's you know he's doing the process that he's writing about as he's writing it.
Yes. Yeah. The only thing I would say is that because he packed so much material in there, that it is maybe a little bit too easy to gloss over some of the really important stuff. Like, the four approaches, I think, are really, really important. But he explains all of them in a span of like 10 pages because he's got so much other stuff right in the book.
So maybe there's that, but, and maybe that's why I was such a big fan of it, because it was extremely dense and I like dense books.
Yeah, I do too. It did not feel like any of the words that he wrote were unnecessary.
So let's jump into action items here, because one, we're long, and two, I have a bunch. So one of which I already have done. So I talked about the email thing. That was on my list to get done, but I feel like I've got that done at this point. I'm going to say I'm done with the email thing, Mike. I'm going to say that I'm going to be done working on systems and how to manage the input of email. I probably still have some work to do on how I write them, but I'm not sure where that lands quite yet. So I'm going to say that part's done. One thing that I've been doing, and I mentioned this earlier, was the writing of the hourly schedule down per day. But he has a method on how to track those deep work hours per week. And part of my system of how I write things down, I've been putting down like goals for a week anyway. So it was pretty easy for me to say, okay, this is week number 32 out of the year. These are the three or four things I want to get done for this week. So I'm just adding on, putting his tick marks per the number of deep work hours I get done in a week on there. So that's an action item I'm taking forward.
Nice.
One of them I have on here is a shutdown ritual. I noticed you have this one down here as well. I wrote one of these a couple months back, but I never actually started using it. I was calling it an end of business ritual, where there was a series of things you do at the end of your workday to essentially get yourself ready for the next day so that you don't have to continue thinking about it when you go home. So it was it's a method to help you create that separation between work and personal, as far as the separation between the time you're at work and the time you go home. So I went ahead and put one in place. I can't say it's a habit or it's a normal thing, because I've only been doing it a couple days. But the couple of days I've done it, it's been extremely helpful. So I'm going to try to continue doing that.
Yeah, this is something that I've been working on and somewhat implementing. I just have not really devoted I've not really prioritized it to the level that I should. But there are a couple things that I've implemented into my shutdown ritual. Now I just got to get more consistent with it. But that is something that is very, very important, I feel, especially after reading this book, being a knowledge worker, because I think that is a really important difference between somebody who is creating something physical, like a carpenter, for example. You know that I have to apply the polish or whatever. I'm not a woodworker, so I couldn't give you the terms, but like,
you're gonna
the
finish
stain.
It.
you're gonna go ahead, you're gonna stain these chairs, and then there's nothing else that you can do with that. You gotta let it sit overnight. So you're done. Okay, but with knowledge work, there's always more words to write. There's always more work I could be doing on these videos. So it's really hard for me to completely disengage whenever I'm done and really not just keep looking throughout the rest of the evening for, oh, is there a pocket of time where I can get just a little bit more work done? And in my own life, I justify that because I say, well, if I do this today, then tomorrow's going to be easier. And really what I realize after reading this book is like, I got to stop that. I got to have a set end time, and I've got to have that ritual that allows me to disengage. And he even talks about how when you do, when you don't do the shutdown ritual correctly, then you're actually robbing your productivity from the next day because you're not getting the reset that your body really needs. So definitely something I need to do. I also mentioned I want to start scheduling my offline blocks. I sort of am doing that to a limited degree, not completely offline, with how I work with my iPad Pro, but this is specifically completely offline. I want to have specific times where I cannot get notified anyway. And then also I mentioned earlier scheduling every minute of every day using that fixed schedule productivity system, which I believe actually goes along with the shutdown ritual. If I have a set time that I want to be finished by, everything that I schedule has to be done before that time. So I think those kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah. And the only other thing I have as far as action items, and I've kind of mentioned this already. I think we get kind of excited of this is what I'm going to do, but trying to scale back on the social media stuff. Cause at this point in the game for me, Mike, I know that especially things like Instagram and Facebook, it just doesn't, there's really not much benefit in them at all. So if you follow the any benefit principle, those need to go. So deleting Instagram off my phone was the first step there. I'm not going to say I'm off of Instagram yet, but it's still, it's very hard for me to get to it right now. Facebook, I haven't really done anything with it in years, much to my family's chagrin. So, whoops. So those are easy ones. Twitter's a difficult one for me because that's where I've previously said that's where I'm going to hang out. But the more time I spent thinking about that as opposed to this discussion site that I run behind the site, I really feel like that's where I need to be directing my focus. And the more that I'm able to direct my focus in that direction, I think the better off I am because I like to share articles. I like to share what I'm learning and something I've discovered. I like to do that and share those with other people. But I'm not so certain that Twitter is the right space for it. So, I mean, people will say that you want to do that because you can get links and it can get back to your site. And it's kind of a you click on mine, I'll click on yours type of thing. But I don't think that in the long run that really helps. You know, if I look at the number of people that come from Twitter onto my site, honestly, it's pretty small in comparison. You know, if I look at, I don't even know how many followers I have on Twitter right now, but it's significantly more than I was at a year ago. I think I'm somewhere around 800, and maybe a year ago I was at like 300, somewhere around those lines. But honestly, you're not getting, you know, a handful of clicks that come off of those. So I don't think those really... It's not a place that I feel I should be spending a lot of time because I know that if people are in the discussion site, one, they've either left a comment on my site, which means they're engaged with the content that I write, or two, they felt that the type of thing that I write is interesting enough to join that community. So to me, the target audience that I want to be working for and to are the folks that are a part of that discussion site. So that's where I feel like I want to spend a lot of my time. So I'm going to be trying to direct more of my attention there. I'll probably still post things on Twitter. Obviously, I will on the Bookworm Twitter feed since I control that one. Can you have more than one person control a Twitter account?
Probably not control it, but you could have people contribute it for sure.
Okay.
So I can help you do some of that. And I want to make a distinction here with the action items because I think it can maybe be a little bit overwhelming if you're listening. You say, oh, well, Joe and Mike are applying all of these radical changes every time they read a book. It's not necessarily really radical changes, but it's the implementation of at Asian Efficiency. We have a core value called Kaizen where it's kind of like constant improvement. And so these are all things that I've noted as I read the book, like, hey, I should try that. And when I try that, if it produces not just any benefit, but if it really does hit the mark and it really does resonate and I see the results and I decide that, yeah, that's the thing that is really going to make a difference. And I'm going to go ahead and apply that. But I think that if you just look at the list of takeaways every single time, maybe it's a little bit overwhelming, but just know that these are things that we're going to try, not necessarily that we're going to commit to radical lifestyle changes every single time. Is that the way you view these?
Absolutely, because I don't meditate anymore. It's like, well, that was one of the first things is, okay, I need to start meditating more in order to help drive more focus in my brain. I can't do it, Mike. And it doesn't even show. Like, I could do it for weeks on end, and it doesn't really, I can't see any difference in doing it. So I'm not going to take the time to do it. So, yes, there are some things that we take as action items, and they fall off. And in some cases, it's very quickly. There was one. I don't remember what it was. There was something that we said, or I said I was going to do. I'm not going to think of it. But I remember I did it for 2 days, and then I quit it. I don't remember what it was. I need to go look it up. I'll look it up for the next one. But, yeah, there's a lot of these, especially probably with this social media thing, because you're coming off the high of just reading this thing, and it's like, yes, I'm going to cancel all of them. I'm going to go build a cabin in the woods, and I'm going to write constantly for 6 months. Like, that's the mindset that you come out of this thinking, and at least that's the way I came out of it. It's like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. But that's not the right approach, not given yep. the work that I do. So I'm just trying to figure out, okay, I'm going to scale back on Twitter. I'm not leaving Twitter. I will definitely still be there, but I'm going to focus more of my time and attention on that discussion site, which honestly is more difficult than Twitter because the posts and the things that go there are longer form and they take more thought to get out. But ultimately, I think that's better for me in the long run, if you can catch the distinction there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense.
So I think by now people know how we're going to rate this, but Mike, how would you rate this?
Well, this was a very influential book for me the first time I read it, and I got probably just as much, if not more, out of it the second time that I read it. So this is definitely 5 out of 5 for me.
Yeah, that's an easy one. I said earlier on, this is one of the few books that's had a pretty major impact on my life, and a very positive way, I would say, similar to getting things done. So yeah, this is an easy 5 for me as well.
So I guess the upcoming books here, if you're following along at home, are The Power of Full Engagement by Jim Lear and Tony Schwartz, which was my pick. We're going to do that one next. And then after that, Daring Greatly by, I'll let you say the guy's name. I'm not sure.
That's the gal's name, Brené Brown.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, no, the Daring Greatly, I've had that one recommended to me a couple times. And that one, it'll break the mold of the type of thing that we're doing. It gets more into relationships as opposed to work. So we'll move topics a little bit at that point.
All right. Sounds good. And then if you want to recommend a book for us to check out, there is a link to do that on the website. So it's bookworm.fm/recommend. And there's also a list of all of the books that we have done, as well as the ones that are planned and recommended at bookworm.fm/list.
And we're still conducting this semi-experiment, I guess is what we'd call it, Mike, over at remarks.fm. So they've got their app, and it's a way to do the social podcasting thing. We've talked about this a few episodes in a row now, but we've had a few people leaving comments on specific points, challenging us on things that we've said and agreeing with us on some things. So it's been kind of fun to see some of that back and forth start to happen. So we're still conducting that experiment. So if you're interested in remarks at all, you can check out the links we've got in the show notes. That'll take you over to both their site and the app that goes with it to engage in that. And then also, I've seen we've got a handful of reviews that are starting to come in. Awesome. Thank you to you guys on iTunes who are leaving reviews over there. If you want, go ahead and check that out. I'll drop a link to the iTunes, what do you call that? The show itself, the link to get to it. That way you can go leave a review there as well. So if you like the show, or even if you don't, we'd love to see a review from you just to let us know what you think of it. And then there's some weird way that iTunes and Apple uses those reviews to create the algorithms in order to help other people find them. So reviews and rating us goes a long ways on the iTunes store. So if you get a chance, go check that out.
Yeah, definitely. We appreciate any feedback that you guys have. We want to make this podcast book club even better. So if you want to join us, go ahead and start reading The Power of Full Engagement by Jim Lear and Tony Schwartz. And we will talk to you guys next time.